You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hey, Connor.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
Doing pretty great today, except the wildfires here in D.C. have turned the city quite an apocalyptic shade of gray.
You know, it's funny. I was in D.C., as you know, because actually you and I had lunch only, it seems like only yesterday was only yesterday. I just woke up from a nap. I have no idea when it is. It was yesterday, right? And it was hot, but otherwise not objectionable. Then I get off the train in Trenton, and it's like, it's the apocalypse. There was all the smoke in the air. I remember only one other time when in this area things were that bad. But now I was telling my wife, I think it's heading down to D.C., and that is apparently true. It has reached you.
Yeah, it is funny. One of my best friends lives in one of the most beautiful parts of southern France, and he always makes fun of me for how bad the weather is in D.C. You know, it's hot, it's humid, you have horrible snowstorms in winter, and now we also have, you know, like smoke and hellfire. So it truly is...
This is his lucky day. He should call you and harass you immediately. So this will probably post several days after the day we're talking about, and the air will once again be, spring-like and clear in Washington, D.C. But anyway, you are Connor Leahy, well-known figure in the AI community, in part because you co-founded a well-known AI research collective called Eleuther AI. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk about that, actually, eventually. It's relevant to the thing we are going to mainly talk about. Since you're at Eleuther, your concerns about the direction that AI is headed in have led you to become the U.S. Executive Director of Control AI, a nonprofit, which has a branch there in D.C. and also one in London, I think. It's a group that looks at, you know, AI policy, and you do advocacy, and you meet with politicians and various other people. In fact, the two people I saw later that day, I guess I won't mention their names, but, both say they know you. You've talked to everybody. This is impressive because these are like known people that I was talking to. More known than I am, and they know you. So anyway, we are going to talk about the worldview that is helping to shape the, quote, AI race, because we're going to try to kind of flesh out the worldviews that prevail within the companies that are leading the AI race, notably Anthropic, OpenAI, maybe to some extent Google. Google DeepMind, although it is only over the last few months it has come to seem to many observers, I don't know, but more like a two-horse race between Anthropic and OpenAI. These things change. Who knows what Google will release tomorrow? But in terms of the two frontier models, right now, it seems like Mythos slash Fable, Fable being the Mythos with guardrails, that we hope will not be circumvented. But I think you, if I asked, you would say guardrails often get circumvented, right? And then Opus, not Opus, but ChatGPT 5.6 and the OpenAI said, those are the two, before we get into the larger questions I nodded toward, those are like the two big models available to the public now, right?
Yeah, I think most people would say that those are the strongest currently available models.
Mm-hmm. And let's just spend a minute, because the Fable Mythos thing got so much attention. First, Mythos comes out, and it's like, this is a super hacking thing. And there was argument, oh, that's just hype. I think there's more and more consensus that this was this has non-trivial cyber capabilities. It is still not really out. It's being used by certain institutions, including the private sector, to help tighten up their infrastructure before a model like it gets out or becomes so readily available that it's being used by the bad guys as they see them to break into their infrastructures. And then they released this guardrail version called Fable. The Trump administration basically took it off the market to evaluate it, then put it back on. What's your quick take before we get into the whole worldview / ideology of these organizations? Because that is a fascinating story that I don't think many people appreciate, and you are very conversant in, partly by virtue of your own history and the fact that you know these people and so on. But before we get into that, what's your take on the mythos fable thing?
I think it's one of the most interesting things that's happened in AI in quite a long time, especially when it comes to politics. But also, to speak a little bit also about the ideology of the kind of people you're talking about. In many AI safety circles, there's this obsession with what they call the warning shot, where some minor catastrophe or moderate catastrophe will happen that doesn't quite, lead to human extinction, and this will make people wake up. Well, it has happened. And it was Mythos. As far as I'm concerned, we had the director of the NSA, actual guy, the actual General Rudd, director of the NSA, saying to the Gang of Eight, which are the top-ranking, members of the oversight committees, that Mythos was capable into breaking into almost all their classified systems in hours, not weeks. Now, a statement like this, it's hard to really overstate how much that is a statement that a national security person never wants to hear in their life.
And you think it was an accurate statement?
I generally think that when the director of the NSA speaks to the Gang of Eight, he is providing accurate information.
Okay.
I think there are nuances to this. There are always nuances. Of course there are. It probably was as part of a red teaming exercise. It probably, et cetera. But that doesn't mean that this wasn't a crazy thing to have happened. Since then, there's also been other crazy things that have happened. Recently, the director of the CIA, not to be left out, said that it wouldn't be wrong to compare AI to digital nukes. These are strong statements from some of the most, informed and powerful people in the military and intelligence apparatuses. This is not random people. This is not, doomers. These are the guys. And to say words this strong on the record, my interpretation personally is that it's much worse than we think it is. To get them to say that is probably means much worse things have happened. And, I'm not saying I know such things. And if I did, I wouldn't confirm it. But, this is not to be underestimated how big of a deal this is to get people to act this strongly on this. 2 months ago, Stone, people would tell me regularly, all the time, people would tell me, Connor, you should give up. Why are you even trying? It's impossible. Trump said
what goal did they say is impossible?
Oh, to regulate AI. They said it's impossible.
And I should say in particular, one of your organization's stated goals is to stop and even make illegal super intelligence, which is a thing we haven't reached. Maybe make illegal is not quite the way you'd put it, but that's, some groups are like, okay, our main goal is pause now. That's it. I'm pretty sure that wouldn't bother you a lot, but your main stated goal is stop before super intelligence, right? You're not trying to ban all AI or anything, but that's the thing you do want to ban.
That is correct. So we at Control AI are very much single issue in the sense that we are not against AI in general. We just want it to be controlled. And in particular, we are against super intelligence. These are fully autonomous AI systems that are vastly more competent humans across all relevant tasks. If such a system existed, it would outcompete humans at all relevant economic, military, and political goals and tasks. And as such, we have no idea how we would control something like that. Okay. So such a system is so dangerous that it could lead to literal extinction, as has been warned by, literal Nobel Prize winning scientists, including some of the people who invented modern AI, such as Geoffrey Hinton, who, won the Nobel Prize related to this. So this is not a niche concern.
Okay, and so you were saying when your friends, I think I interrupted you when you were saying, your friends say give up on this goal, Connor?
Yeah, so what they say, Connor, you should give up on trying to get regulation or so on, because Trump has said he will never regulate AI. And I always answered, yeah, we'll see. And in fact, we have seen, is that a thing to understand about politics is the way politics works is that something is completely impossible until it very suddenly isn't. So what I find most interesting about the fable and the Mythos saga is how quickly something that was considered completely impossible, unimaginable, that the government would intervene on the AI market, can happen very suddenly when people realize, oh shit, this is a big deal. This is a very dangerous thing. What the hell is going on here? So I think there's a lot of stuff in the background that happened there. And I'm not saying all of it was super rational or like well thought out or like necessarily legal, but I think it's very indicative of seeing that, you know, the quote unquote adults in the room, you know, the military, the government, et cetera, are waking up to, wait, what the hell is going on here? This is getting crazy.
Yeah. And I would say Trump then went on to take OpenAI's kind of rival of Fable, the aforementioned 5.6, ChatGPT 5.6, and it took it off the market for a briefer examination, I would say. And I know what your view is on how close it is to being comparable to Mythos / Fable's capabilities. But it's now on the market. And people who really, you know, connoisseurs like you, I assume you'd agree, say that, yeah, Fable and I guess, and most of them, I think, say 5.6 as well. This is a significant step. You just feel it. It's just a smarter thing, even if you're not trying to use its cyber capabilities, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the same way as the difference between, like, you know, Opus 3, Opus 4, you know, then you go from Opus 4.8 to Fable. Yep, yeah. It's just much smarter. Mm-hmm. It is more capable. It can run for longer autonomous periods. It can perform more complex tasks. It makes better decisions more reliably. Does it make zero mistakes? No, of course not. You know, it's not perfect, but it is better.
Yeah. Okay, so as you said, this was in a certain sense, some people's like dream warning shot, right? I mean, because a lot of people, and look, I think you and I would both say that to really, really get the world to focus, you're going to have probably some subsequent dramatic developments. But it's true that people have long said, I just hope the catastrophe it takes to get the world's attention doesn't get a ton of people killed, right? Well, this so far apparently got nobody killed. It was just a really well-publicized capability. And I think personally, it's one reason that maybe the main reason that Trump and Xi during the Beijing summit wound up initiating a formal dialogue on AI. So look, that's a lot of bang per buck. Nobody dies. And, you know, you start moving toward taking this stuff pretty seriously, even though, and I wrote a piece in the Washington Post about this, that you know, look, it's not crazy to take a model of Fable's capabilities and take it off the market and take a good look at it. I'm afraid the government should have that kind of power. At the same time, going forward, we need to have a much more systematized approach in this, and it shouldn't be the caprice of whoever the president is. There needs to be a system. Congress needs to lay it down, and I would say, even possibly need to be involved in some sense in oversight of the oversight mechanism. But that's all. I guess we've waited too long. That's just my view. We've waited too long to get to what I promised to get to, which is like, I don't want to speak. I'm not speaking ill of anyone when I say that some of the leaders in the field, you know, Dario Amodei, maybe Sam Altman, and I'm not sure about Demis Hassabis. Those are the leaders of the big three, as well as other super prominent, important researchers. At least a fair number of these, you know, developed. They're now these super powerful people, and they developed their worldviews in a milieu that I think many Americans, if they knew more about, would go, man, that's super weird. Like these guys, like, you know, wait, I thought like corporate CEOs were these people who just, you know, they joined country clubs or whatever. And even the Silicon Valley variety, right? It's like, they're just these super ambitious, you know, entrepreneurs, founders, and so on. They're intense, blah, blah, blah. This was very, very different, right? It has to do with Eliezer Yudkowsky, now known as the Doomer in Chief, and a culture he was prominent in when he started his Less Wrong blog, which I think you were an early contributor to. And you like know these people, have interacted with them. So You're nodding your head as if I am saying something that you recognize. So why don't you flesh that light, tell us a little about the milieu that shaped some of the leading figures here.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of really fascinating history here, because in many ways, it often looks maybe from the outside, and for some many people it is that AI, in particular AGI and superintelligence, is like a purely...
That's artificial general intelligence.
Yes.
So it's a little hard to define super precisely, but you've already done super for us, and that'll do for now. Go ahead.
Exactly. Like, these terms change regularly. Like, nowadays we say superintelligence. Back in the day we said AGI, whatever. It doesn't matter. The big thing. The thing that can replace humans. Yeah. That's what matters. And these ideas didn't come out of a vacuum. This is not like the, you know, ruthless market decided this is the optimal thing to go for. These are ideas that actually grew out of a very specific ideological lineage that I would say really started with what is called the Extropians. So,
whoa.
Yeah.
That's hardcore. There was a weird story, a few months ago about some Extropians who were involved in some weird crime, right? But you're not, but we don't need to, we don't want to tar them all. Extropianism per se is a worldview. Now, what is it?
Extropianism is a, I would say, particularly intense form of what's called transhumanism more broadly. Transhumanism is a very, very broad set of philosophies that in various ways are about a belief that humanity should be improved or transcended in various ways. This can be
through technological means in particular, not just through like meditating.
Yes, generally, especially by... Some of them are also very into meditating, especially some of the newer ones are very, very into meditating. We'll get to that.
Are you thinking of Baselord, by the way, on Twitter?
He's like a classic example of like the archetypical SF meditation accelerationist guy.
And a total accelerationist, the faster the better, but he's always telling us about the jhana states he's realized, great.
Yeah. We'll get there in the story. So like another thing to understand about San Francisco is San Francisco as a place and Silicon Valley is a really weird place. And it really has like, I would say, three main ideological strains that kind of all mix and mutate in this like stew. And these three are the transhumanist, techno-utopian kind of visions, and also coming from like Golden Age sci-fi and stuff like that, which we're talking about. The other one is just cutthroat capitalism, libertarianism. And the third is true New Age communist, you know, crazy hippie, you know, ideology. All of these are core to the soul of Silicon Valley. And if you neglect any one of them, you won't understand what's actually going on. So all of these cultures of all of these companies, of people who live there, of people who grew up there and so on, should be understood as being influenced by these like three large ideological clusters to varying degrees. You know, some people are way more into the hippie stuff. Some people are way more just, you know, capitalists that don't really care. Other people are like really into like the techno-utopian kind of vision of various kinds. And then there's the overlaps, like open source to a large degree is an ideology that's between techno-utopianism and libertarianism. It has a lot of this like anti-authoritarianism, while also believe that like technology is good and will like improve humanity, will improve the world, etc. So there's a lot of various mixtures of these ideologies to be had.
Okay.
And yeah, so this is where I think the origin of like this culture kind of comes from. And then the modern version of what you now see in many of these like AGI, you know, religions or cults almost, is coming from the Extropians, who are in a particularly intense form of transhumanism that kind of emerged in the 80s by a guy named Max Mora, I think, was the one who first coined the term. And Extropianism was all about exponential growth. It was this idea that we could get exponential amounts of, you know, energy and growth and intelligence and improve everything at like unbelievable levels. That we would not just... So some transhumanisms are quite mild. They're like, hey, we should have better medicine. So
brain chips, look, we use brain chips therapeutically for certain kinds of maladies. And so it kind of happens. But there are these relatively mild forms of
So there are some relatively mild forms. Like Extropius is a pretty extreme form. Extropianism often quickly was one of the first ones to really seriously grapple with some very intense ideas, such as, you know, whole brain uploading, immortality, you know, and AGI. So, and superintelligence as concepts. They were some of the first people to really think seriously about some of these ideas in the 80s and the 90s. And so Max Moore and his wife, you know, in the 1990s, got a visit from a 19-year-old Jewish boy named Eliezer Yudkowsky, and who was on their mailing list.
And who, by his own account, if I've got it right, so I think his parents were Orthodox, but in any event, it was a religious family. Yeah. He, I think by his own account, he has said science fiction kind of became his religion. I'm not sure if he said that, but anyway, he did not become conventionally religious. He got into science fiction at an early age. I like him. I've had him on the podcast. And look, we both, I think we talked about this a little yesterday. I think that he really, he deserves high praise. He has some very distinctive accomplishments. Maybe we'll get into, and he foresaw some things, but anyway, I interrupt you. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So Eliezer was someone who was very early on the like Extropian mailing list and so on, talking about these ideas of superintelligence. I didn't exactly call it that back then, but that's what they were talking about. This idea of if you had this recursively self-improving, so AI that can improve itself, you could make very quickly, you could build these incredibly powerful, superintelligent beings that could cure all diseases, you know, could solve all problems, could, you know, turn the whole universe into whatever, nanobots or whatever, like really intense sci-fi stuff. And I don't mean sci-fi dismissively. Like, I think there's a lot of valid philosophy that was going on here. I'm okay with philosophers talking about crazy things, right? Like, for example,
it's
also on
doing them that you need to pay close attention.
Yeah, exactly. I'm all fine for people, you know, thinking about crazy ideologies. Implementing them is when it becomes, you know, tricky. So, growing out of this, and Eliezer's interest in this topic, in the late 90s and the early 2000s, he actually splinters off from the Extropians and creates what's called a mailing list called SL4, which is where we see some of the first overlap with some names you might otherwise recognize. SL4 was a mailing list for talking about these most intense, like kind of even more intense than Extropianism, like the most intense forms of like future sci-fi speculation.
And what are some of the names we might recognize?
Shane Legge, co-founder of DeepMind. Nick Bostrom, the popularizer of the term superintelligence.
He's been on the podcast and he wrote the big book Superintelligence, which in turn shaped a lot of thinking. I think Shane Legge came up with the term AGI, didn't he?
I think he did, yes, if I remember correctly.
Okay, so go ahead. Any other big... that's big. That's big.
Yeah. So, right there. There were definitely some people around back then. There's also like one person who was there who has some who invented the precursor to Bitcoin, which was quite interesting. Wei Dai was his name. He almost invented Bitcoin. He was like so close to it. There's also, you know, speculation that Satoshi might have been there or not. I don't know. I think probably not.
The inventor of Bitcoin, whose actual identity is unknown, whose name may or may not be anything like that. Anyway.
Exactly. So, you know, that's why I say it's speculation about who was there or not. But yeah, so there was like a surprising amount of very interesting people that, you know, later became relevant, at least, you know, on this mailing list every so often. And Eliezer then founded an organization called the Singularity Institute. This was in 2000, I believe, or 2001, so very ahead of his time. And you know, you might recognize this, is that the goal was to build AI as fast as possible so that we could have AI that can take over the world and fix all the problems. That was the plan. And so at this time, this is what really would nowadays be called accelerationism. So, you know, the EACs are, you know, little babies compared to Eliezer. You know, he was 20 years ahead of them. So in the early days...
EACs meaning effective, it's a play on effective altruism. They call themselves the effective accelerationists. It's kind of a joke, but the aforementioned Bayes Lord is probably an example. This Beth Jezo's character is also one. So go ahead.
Yeah, just like there's a broader category of accelerationism that I think is not specific to EAC. EAC is more like a Twitter meme, which I think died like a year or two ago anyways.
Good.
But there is a broader form of accelerationism, which goes, I think, all the way back to Nick Land in like the 90s.
Nick Land, who is, I gather, we don't need to get into all, go down all these things, but I don't know anything about, but people who know go, ooh, kind of like ideologically, he went to some places that some people consider dark, I guess, and we can leave it at that.
Yeah, I would say Nick Land is someone who tried to optimize to be as edgy as possible as a philosopher, mm-hmm. to come up with mm-hmm. the most repulsive possible ideologies he could. And he did a pretty good job of it.
Okay, well, hats off.
Yeah, but I think he had one insight that I do think is very interesting for the story, which is that in the very early days, Nick Land was a communist. He was a Marxist. Mm-hmm. And he's not anymore. Oh, God, is he not? But in the early days, so the idea of accelerationism, the word accelerationism, actually comes from Marxism, historically. So Marxist accelerationism is the idea that the thing a Marxist should do is actually do as much capitalism as possible, as fast as possible, because capitalism is inherently unstable. So if you accelerate capitalism, it will at some point collapse under its own contradictions. And then
right in the contradictions, as they say in Marxist circles.
As they love to say. And then this will somehow, ? Lead to the communist utopia of some kind. So this is this idea of Marxist accelerationism. Is that like...
Did these accelerationists have something they wanted to collapse? I mean, was it all the institutions constraining geniuses like them or what?
So the Marxists want to destroy capitalism. The modern accelerationists, I think, inherit, like what you're saying, is that a lot of what modern these accelerationists really believe is that they are extremely annoyed by governments, by laws, by anything that is holding them back. They often feel, this is where this libertarian strain comes in. So the original Marxist accelerationists weren't really thinking about technology. They were thinking about like destroying capitalism. And then there was this development in accelerationism as a concept, I think, to a large degree. This is more my speculation, but like basically, Nick Land made a pretty good observation about accelerationism, where he said, he speculated that, well, in the Marxist theory, as you expand the amount of capital that exists, that you have less and less labor, more and more capital as part of the pie chart, so to speak, at some point, labor would revolt and the communist revolution would start. But Nick Land speculated, wait, what if that doesn't happen? What if capital just keeps expanding indefinitely? What if there is just no more labor and there's just only capital? What then? And so this kind of, and this was like in the 80s and the 90s, and he basically predicted AI and AGI, is that what if you could just have sentient capital that can just replace all labor? If you can substitute labor with capital, then labor is no longer necessary. And this is then where things take a very dark turn in Landian philosophy and get very, very dark, because he basically then concludes that this is good and all humans should die.
And there is, well, we need, I don't go off on that tangent. But anyway, so Nick Land was a prominent person in this. And this was still like an email list, among other things?
I don't think he was ever on the email list. He was kind of more like a parallel offshoot. He was kind of like a parallel idea. Like there are many interesting, there's a lot of people I'm also leaving off here and so on. But yeah, so basically.
I got to say, for people who have, younger than me with great literary ambitions, there is a great intellectual history to be done about all this, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, my God. Like there's much to be
told.
That
will be unlike other intellectual history. People say, like, where are the Parisian cafes of, like, the 30s or something? Yeah. Or whenever these people were. Camus and Sartre, maybe the 40s or whatever. But, this was a very influential set of very unusual ideas that took shape, like, under the surface, like, under the table. I don't mean they were hiding it. It's just we didn't know. I mean, I guess you could say Wired magazine was a certain kind of oblique manifestation of some of this, and that got people's attention. I remember when it was, when it showed up. But, and now all of a sudden, these guys are, like, ruling go ahead.
I mean, fun fact, one of the first people to give Eliezer Bunny was Peter Thiel.
I know. And then, of course, Eliezer did the 180 and became not a techno-optimist, but quite the opposite. And hats off to him for, it's hard to kind of, to turn your back on all on in a certain sense on the people who supported you and so on. But that's where his ideas took him. So, okay, so I interrupted. You can proceed with the narrative.
Yeah, and so, yeah, as you just said, so Eliezer, to his incredible credit, I really, really want to give him credit here. Like, there's many things to, you know, disagree with Eliezer about, but I think it's an immense credit to him that, like, I think 2004, maybe, I don't know exactly the timeline here, Eliezer realized, oh, shit, I made a mistake. How do you control a superintelligence? Like, what does that even mean? If you build something that's smart, by default, this does not go well. And so he pivots entirely to thinking about how do you build safe AI? How do you build safe? Back then it was called friendly AI, but what we would now call like safe or controllable or aligned.
Aligned, AI. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, alignment is, became the term. Can I just quickly, I assume there were science fiction, examples to build that worldview on. Like you know, obviously science fiction writers had said, right, and this AI thing could wind up ruling the world. So I guess he had reference the ENTS to latch onto.
Yep, there's a lot here actually. So I was quite. I remember reading when I read some of Eliezer's worldview. So after his kind of come to God moment about like the risks of AI, he started developing this ideology that he would call rationalism, for better or for worse, and. A lot of this ideology had a lot of interesting aspects that I found very novel, at least as a teenager. I'd never heard of these things before. But very fascinatingly, I then read one of his favorite 1950s sci-fi books, which was called, I think, World of Aleph Null or something like this. I'd never heard about it before. It's quite obscure. And it's about a guy who has a kind of who has learned a kind of mental martial arts where you can like rationally solve problems very quickly using, you know, systems of rationality. And I'm like, wow, that seems familiar. So a lot of this is drawn from Golden Age sci-fi ideas. Also like stuff like, you know, Ian Banks, but also stuff like I.J. Goode, for example, is one of the first people to talk about the intelligence explosion, recursive self-improvement, stuff like this, you know, who was a sci-fi author. So there's a lot of, I think it's worth not dismissing here just because it comes from fiction doesn't mean there isn't interesting philosophy that was going on.
Absolutely not. I mean, these people, you know, some of them were visionaries, some of these science fiction writers. So you were in Eliezer world before he turned to pessimist, or this is around the time you started paying attention?
I unfortunately was still too young to be on the internet at this time. Okay. So this is before my time. I have just done my archaeology. That I have done a lot of internet archaeology on this kind of stuff. And so there's an interesting part of the story, which is usually left out, which I think is very important to include. So you said this kind of earlier, which like, oh, there's all these things going on that we just didn't know about. And it wasn't like they were hiding it. Well, you would be wrong. They were, in fact, hiding it. So this was a thing in the early days of this movement. Very early on, there was a strong part of the ideology is that don't tell people. Don't let the stupid, unwashed masses know about this. Don't let the government know about this because they're crazy. You know, they're stupid. They don't understand it. We, the smart elites, who are super smart, we're going to solve the problem. You know, we're going to solve everything. You know, just to make sure that all these dumb, stupid, you know, normal people don't get in the way. So this is the dark framing on what actually happened. There's the positive.
And there was some discussion of this on the record, because it seems like about a year ago there was a controversy, an intramural controversy about this among people from this milieu, right? Wasn't there kind of an argument? Some stuff came out, or somebody said, you know, here's this email and here's this and that, and there was a whole thing.
This feels like it happens every 6 months. You know, like there's a lot of infighting inside of these milieus, right? And like I'm also part of this, is that like one of the reasons I have broken a lot with these group of people is because I think it is extremely bad to hide this kind of information from people in the government. I think people are allowed to have insight and, you know, decision making on this thing. Doing this unilaterally is deeply immoral. And so this is a thing where I'm sure we're going to get into that, where there. So here's where the libertarianism kind of really like mixes with this techno-optimism, where this idea that the few elites, you know, the John Galtz, the like, you know, the Randian Ubermensch, you know, in Silicon Valley, who are so much smarter than all these other, you know, people, have to just like you know, sit in the basement and like, you know, figure it out and, you know, just make sure the government doesn't get in the way. And this will rear its head many times in the future as well. So I think this is a very important part of the ideology to understand, is that this worship of intelligence, this worship of the lone genius hacker, the lone genius founder that is, the Ayn Rand character, so to speak.
Yeah. It's funny, you know, so I co-founded this platform called bloggingheads.tv, one of the first video dialogue platforms in 2005. And a guy who was helping me, working with me, helped me line up people, he brought on people like Eliezer was on, even before I did a podcast with him like in 2010 or something. But I think by 2006 or seven, he was, and I just remember, I'm like, who the hell is this? And you know, I got to admit, like many people, I didn't entirely warm up to his persona because I felt he was he's a total autodidact, okay? He taught himself. And as happens with these people, sometimes like there's an idea that a lot of people already know about. You don't have to give it a new name, right? Like I remember back when I was like 18 and I thought I had discovered utilitarianism. No, it's not a new idea. Anyway, so by that time he was turning and so he becomes him, Doomer in Chief. Meanwhile, the branch that he branches off from eventually begets, I guess you would say, Dario, maybe Sam Altman. I'm not so sure about him. You might say Shane Legg, co-founder with Demis Hassabis of DeepMind. You're nodding your head, so you might, looks like. So go ahead and let's stick with that branch and keep telling the story.
Great, yeah. So second half of the 2000s, a couple really interesting things starts happening. One thing is that DeepMind has found it. DeepMind, including seed capital from Peter Thiel, which was introduced by Eliezer. Mm-hmm. Eliezer introduced Peter Thiel to Demis and Shane to get some of their initiative. I think, and this is sometimes a little bit mythologized, I don't think all of the money came from Peter Thiel or this one conversation, but it still was a pivotal moment and shows this overlap between the DeepMind and kind of like the Eliezer and like the like race dynamic thing. And so the thing the ideology kind of believed at this point in time, I don't want to say like any specific person believed this, but the ideological belief was something like, still, DeepMind is good because if we could just put all the smart people into one company and keep the government and everyone else away, then we can do it right. Then we can do it properly because then we will have control. And this is where this idea really came into being. And I've talked to people who were there at the time, and they all believe versions of this. I don't want to attribute it to specific people because these are private conversations, but like these people really believed a version of, as long as we, the good people, do it in a secret, you know, company project, et cetera, then it can be good. It's worth pausing here just for a second to compare this to other historical examples, such as the Manhattan Project. Because this is kind of what happened. In a sense, Eliezer is kind of like Leo Szilard, or maybe like Shane Legg is like, let's see Leo Szilard. He's realizing...
Szilard is the physicist who is maybe the, I guess, the origin kind of the letter that was ultimately sent to Roosevelt that Einstein signed that said, we've got this shit. If you're in the middle of a war, maybe you should build a bomb.
Yeah, right? Basically what happened was is that before Szilard, famously Lord Kelvin, a very famous scientist, said that the idea of getting net energy from fission is moonshine. It's impossible. It's silly. And Szilard was so upset by this that he immediately came up with a design for how to build a nuclear bomb and how it would work. And he basically realized, like, he wrote it down and it just worked out. And he was like, oh shit, this will work. And so what did he do? Well, he ran out and started a startup to have a competition to build as many nuclear bombs as possible at an affordable price to sell them to as many people as possible. Wrong timeline.
Actually, in that case, there's reason to think that this one may not work out as well as that one worked, because with nuclear weapons, at least deterrence turned out to be this fundamentally simple dynamic. I don't want to get into that, but it's a different kettle of fish. The reason we haven't had a nuclear bomb go off since World War II is easier to understand than it is to understand how this thing, if it continues to be a headlong race, won't go awry. But in any event, so you were saying that the people who I guess the most obvious comparison, you don't want to talk about individuals, I'm sure, so you don't, I won't even tell people whether you're nodding your head, although we are on video, but the name that comes to mind with me is Dario Amodei, and for that matter, Sam Altman. I mean, they both professed to be very concerned about the possibility that, yes, this could lead to human extinction, and they are both just moving as fast as they possibly can toward this fate, all the while saying that there's something about their approach that's not going to lead to the bad outcome, or something about where they're leading us that's not going to lead to the bad outcome, even though, I don't know, you tell me. Anyway, you pick up the story here. That's kind of the comparison. There's a large comparison.
So I think we're starting to assemble all the ideological building blocks that lead to the, you know, rickety edifice that we're at now, where there's one block missing, which is kind of like Oxford University, utilitarianism, Peter Singer, and McCaskill, which led to what is called effective altruism. So there's another strain of thought.
We should say Peter, who's a pretty good friend of mine, he should be absolved. I mean, I'm sure you'd agree that he doesn't get into this stuff. Like his idea of effective altruism is be very careful about which philanthropy you give your money to. I mean, but he would say, look, by my lights, it's better to save 10,000 kids in Africa with mosquito nets than to build another art museum. You can argue with that, but that's a very different kettle of fish. And his version of EA is like, let's do those kinds of calculations.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So the original effective altruism is exactly what you described, and I think is really not that controversial. Like the idea that we should just evaluate which charities, for example, help the most people, I think is a very reasonable thing to do. So this is why it's interesting, because in a sense, there's kind of a bait and switch where you read on the tin what EA says, and you say, well, that seems very reasonable. But then if you open the tin, you're suddenly going to see a lot of crazy stuff. You suddenly see, you know, your Anthropics, you know, and your whatever, your people saying that actually replacing humans with AI is good, maybe, or that, you know, we have to race to ASI, or like many, many crazy things. And how did this happen? And I think this is very interesting, where what happened basically is that this pretty non-objectionable version of, you know, EA merged through this shared link of utilitarianism with like rationalism and this libertarianism, and it's like Bay Area, Silicon Valley culture to create kind of the new mutant ideology. And this grew out to a large degree from, so one of the largest and most important early EA organizations was called GiveWell. So this was an organization that evaluated charities for effectiveness and would help you like make better donations, which I think is a very reasonable thing to do. It was founded by a previous hedge fund manager named Holden Karnofsky. And Holden later then got to know one of the Facebook founders, Dustin Moskovitz. Dustin Moskovitz decided to donate a very, very large amount of money to a foundation that Holden Karnofsky would lead. And this became what is called open philanthropy. So it is now called
Which now funds, for example, what range of things? An interesting, if you look at all the places its money has gone or is going, it's maybe not a group you to, I mean, what would you say are some of the highlights of where its money has gone?
It's gone to OpenAI, to Anthropic, to METR, to...
Which is a safe, well, yeah, I mean, it does this, these evals, these interesting and useful gauges of the progress of AI, and then some AI, I mean, meters maybe borderline AI safety, but some things known as AI safety NGOs, right?
Yes, lots of things are known as AI safety NGOs, you know, like your Redwoods or your whatevers, you know, and like many things. It was, what is important to understand about open philanthropy is that like it is the beating heart of the financial system of EA, is that the engine that kind of fed effective altruism to a large degree in Silicon Valley specifically came through Dustin Moskovitz's money being funneled through open philanthropy. It's hard to overstate how big of an influence they were. It's not the only funder. It's not the only thing that was going on, but it was truly the, you know, 900-pound gorilla.
And then Karnofsky, the, I guess, former hedge fund guy, He married Dario Amodei's sister. Is that correct? And she now is a, well, I forget her title at Anthropic. But
yes. Yeah. In fact, Dario and Holden were roommates for over 10 years. Mm. So before any of this, Dario, Holden Karnofsky.
And why didn't I have a roommate like that?
I know, right? You should have been on the right email list.
So here we are talking to each other, Connor, because neither of us had a roommate like that.
Exactly. Exactly. So I think it's really, I think it's really interesting because, and their third roommate was Paul Cristiano, the inventor of RLHF and a very famous.
More of an inside name, but in the early debates about AI, he and Eliezer are engaged and so on. And he did not follow Eliezer into Doomerland. But is a respected intellect in the realm, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. So he invented RLHF, the technique that allowed ChatGPT to be possible.
Reinforcement learning through human feedback.
Exactly, which allowed ChatGPT to be possible while he was at OpenAI. Mm-hmm. He later founded an AI safety organization called ARC, and then he became head of the Center for AI Security in the U.S. government. I don't think he is that anymore, but he was for a while.
Okay.
So he's kind of one of those background characters that actually had quite a lot of influence. Mm-hmm. And so what you'll see is that the same names keep popping up quite a bit. Like, you can kind of pick and choose almost anyone of like the, you know, here, and there'll be a connection. There'll be a connection to OpenPhil or to Miri or, you know, Eliezer to, you know, to DeepMind. Like, there's a lot of connections going on. These people all know each other. And this is why I think it's so fascinating, is that there wasn't AGI superintelligence scene long before the technology existed, long before it existed, and it overlapped very heavily with these other, you know, adjacent ideologies like rationalism and effective altruism and so on. And this world is extremely incestuous, extremely incestuous.
At this point, we're talking metaphorically, presumably.
Hopefully,
yeah. I mean, the only reason I said this is because I know there is this, and this doesn't involve literal incest even, but there is this sexual dimension of the culture of at least some of this. I don't want to say everybody, but this has been common. I mean, for example, the polyamory thing, and I had somebody on to talk about this, a practitioner and member of the rationalist community years and years ago. But that became intertwined kind of with rationalism in the Silicon Valley or in the San Francisco, Northern California context.
And here's where the third root comes in that I warned earlier about the hippie stuff. This is where it comes in. So, and then the missing root to understand this culture is just the absolute most insane, degenerate, out of all containment, cult stuff. I am actually saying this derogatory and to a certain degree.
Sounds kind of like you're headed there. Yeah, go ahead.
But what I'm saying here to a degree is that consenting adults. I think consenting adults should be allowed to join cults. They're still cults, you know. Like I think it should be completely legal for a consenting adult to join a crazy cult. I will never stop them. I might advise them against it. But that being said, it is hard to understand for people who have not been there how culty literally all of this is.
What is there? Like we've talked about a number of, you know, we've talked about effective altruism, rationalism, extropianism. What can you better define the subculture or the fusion of these or the intersection of some on some Venn diagram? That is what the universe you're talking about now?
This extended cluster that is located primarily in Berkeley and San Francisco.
Okay.
That's the primary part. There's just an extended scene. It's not one ideology, it's a scene, you know? Some of it is EA, some of it is rationalism, some of it is just, you know, AI company employees, some of it is magical alternative healing practitioners are part of this culture. You know, there's a lot of stuff
that seems not consistent with rationalism. I mean, who knows what's out there in this crazy universe, but.
Well, so this is where we get into the cult thing, where, one of the things about cults is that no cult calls itself a cult. And smart people like to think they can't fall for cults. And ironically, this actually makes a lot of smart people very vulnerable to cults. So a lot of people who think they're thinking you're not vulnerable to cult is a risk factor for getting caught into a cult. So what has happened in a lot of these areas is that a lot of these people, so one of the things I understand about this extended scene, it doesn't really have a name, but like the extended cluster of like all of these adjacent ideologies and beliefs and so on, is that they have extreme levels of openness and that they're willing to try anything. And they think they're immortal. They think they're like, you know, they're, you know, Ayn Rand characters, you know, they're so smart, they can solve anything. So they're happy. So for example, drug use is extremely prolific in these things. They'll take psychedelics to try to get new insights. You know, they will try crazy meditation techniques. Jhanas is very famous and very popular right now. They will try body work and energy work and whatever, because they're trying to try new things. And so there's this weird thing where on the tin, it says rationalism. But if you go to these actual, you talk to these actual people, you will see a lot of really esoteric things that are like not, like these are not like boring conservative, you know, like, you know, people. These are like, this is where this like hippie, like alternative medicine, meditation culture really comes in and mixes with this to create this strange concoction. Mm.
And now that I've heard where you're going, I would say, you know, meditation, there is, and now I can see more, an actual, there is a rational kind of approach to certain kinds of meditation and so on. So I have a better idea where you're going. And, you know, who knows what not yet recognized herbal medicines, you know, have effects and so on. So you're not talking about you know, telepathic communication, although maybe that too, maybe they said quantum entanglement or so something. But anyway,
If you want a telepathy story, I recommend looking up Leverage Research. It's too long for us a story for right now, but basically it was a cult that kind of helped start effective altruism and then claimed to have developed telepathy and ultimately spiraled into demon possession and stuff like that. It's a crazy story. We don't have time for it. It's kind of peripheral, but it's a great read.
So let me ask you, what are the features of this group that make it a cult? Generally, when I think of a cult, I think of like blind obedience to somebody or something, for example. And then there are other things, and there are a lot of traits you could attribute kind of definitionally to a cult. What is it you're saying about this group that you think merits that term? I guess part of it, you would say, is the aforementioned. I guess you're saying, like, it's a little weird to start out maybe, you know, trying to shape the future in a positive direction technologically, which they some of them would say their mission was, and to wind up, I don't know, doing whatever they did. I mean, well, I should also say I got you off on this tangent by talking about sex. We haven't talked about that, but there is the polyamory, right? Like, okay, we can switch mates at the drop of a hat, and regular people may not succeed at this, but we're so, I guess, rational that things like jealousy won't get the better of us or something.
Yes, there are literal whole blogs of people talking about how they have used rationality to, you know, turn off their jealousy, or there's a term called bi-hacking. Because it's irrational not to like men. So what, just hack yourself to like men. Why not? You know, it's rational. So this is a real thing, right? That like people do. And like for me, this is very culty. You know, whether or not you're following a specific guru, this is like messing with your mind in these various ways for part of your like controlling social group and so on, that has its own, you know, weird lingo and like these like weird kind of self-harming activities. What I think is useful to talk about this is not to see it as like a traditional cult. A very traditional cult, you know, you have like one leader that's obeying. Don't get me wrong, that does happen. You know, you have your Leverages and your Ziz and your Zoan, which are classic cults. But I think there's kind of a new generation of cult that we've seen in the internet age, where there's not one specific leader, but still it's self-sustaining. You know, we've also, for example, seen this with like the 764 cult recently. In case you haven't heard of that story, maybe don't look it up if you're having a bad day. It's one of the most horrific things to have happened in the last years.
Are those the guys who they killed people or tried or something?
It's a group of online groomers who try to get children to kill themselves.
Oh, even worse than the one I was thinking of. Okay, yeah, let's get back on the main narrative.
Yes,
but what's track? So I guess you'd say, I mean, it sounds like one reason you're using the word cult is like wait a second. Supposedly, this was a kind of ideology, granted, but it was supposed to be focused on this technological thing. And there were certain assumptions about the way technology would play out, maybe ways you could help play out that way. And suddenly, you've got these seemingly extraneous cultural expressions that don't have any obvious connection to it. And yet, they are kind of part of binding this group together. Yes. Is that what you're saying?
I'll go even further in the sense that what I mean by cult is really is that there's a certain kind of like thing that happens is that if people go too crazy, like if you just put people in a room too tightly, they form a cult. Like, you know what I mean? Like if just people are packed too tightly and, you know, they go a little bit crazy as time goes on. And there's kind of a similar thing that there's just certain patterns that emerge, such as like, you know.
We should say we are not talking about every single individual we have mentioned who has some connection to this.
No, by no
means. We're not saying any of these one people has a connection to all the things we're talking about.
Absolutely.
And to varying degrees, they probably left the part of the culture you're talking about and have nothing to do with it. So no individual indictments are to be assumed here.
Exactly. No individual indictments are to be assumed here. Most of the people that are involved here are people that, you know, the general public wouldn't even know. But yeah, so there's this idea, this thing that happens where people just in practice, like empirically, redevelop certain social controlling structures if they are put in certain circumstances. You know, like controlling each other's speech, like struggle sessions is like a reoccurring theme, you know, like where you like someone has sinned against the group and then other people like sit them down and like scream at them, which is like a thing that like these people love to do. It's like a very common thing.
Is that right? I mean, those are associated with, I think Chinese communism, maybe Cultural Revolution, but they do it. You're saying
they don't call it that, but it happens all like, so one important thing, for example, is also that a lot of these people live in group houses. It's often like seven people in like one house that all are part of the same culture. They all like live at the same campus. They all date each other. They, often multiple people at the same time. They read the same news sources. They have the same lingo. They often have a large, and this brings in this like hero myth from earlier, is that they're often very xenophobic towards people who are not part of the culture. They're often very dismissive, like, the outside world, they don't get us. You know, they don't really understand the true thing that's going on. We're the real rational people, which is classic cult talk. Like that's exactly, you are the true understanders. You have the true knowledge. What is curious about this is that kind of this cult just happened to actually have secret knowledge that turned out to be true. That's kind of what makes this one interesting. Is that
you mean they understood better than most where what could happen with AI?
Yes. This is what I think is so fascinating here, is that, you know, there's a lot of things that are wrong, but fundamentally they did have secret knowledge, which did turn out to be true. If you were in the like cult sphere in like the early 2000s, you did know things about the future that other people didn't know. So this is very intoxicating to people. This is very, very intoxicating to people. And so all things equal, you have a lot of people, a lot of, you know, young, vulnerable people potentially, you know, that, and you have like a few people, you know, or few groups that have all the money, you know, you have your open fills and whatever, and that have a lot of authority. You have your Eliezers and so on that have a lot of authority and a lot of recognition and so on. It's just like, weird things happen, is how I would describe it. I don't think anyone here had bad intentions, per se. I don't think any person here involved was like, I'm going to go create a cult and I'm going to like harm people. I think it's just an emergent thing that happens as part of culture. It's just like, if you do crazy, you know, like mind-altering substances and practices, and you're like sardined in with eight other people that are all part of the same culture, you just kind of develop your own insular culture. And I think this is what happened to a large degree. And again, I'm not saying by any means everyone in Silicon Valley or at these AI companies is, you know, deeply part of this culture. But you'd be surprised how many are. Like, you'd be surprised how much this culture has been very influential on the thoughts of people. Like, even the accelerationists who like to, the EX or whatever, love to present themselves as the anti-EAs. They're part of the same culture. They're the same thing.
The anti-effective altruists, you're saying.
Yeah. Like, these people are the same
thing. They like to say that about themselves, but you're saying they have a certain amount in common culturally.
Yeah, absolutely. Uh-huh. Like, you know, like people like Bayslord or whatever is like the same thing. It's just like, there's like, you know, two bits of difference. Like, but it's like, but almost everything is the same. It still comes with this like, you know, techno-utopian vision, this like vision of like, you know, super intelligence, this like openness to a lot of like alternative, you know, like strange things, you know, like meditation and so on, which I'm not saying is necessarily a bad thing. It's just like, empirically.
Yeah, I should say I'm pro-meditation, as some people know.
I am too, for what it's worth. I meditate every day. I'm not against it. I just think meditation is something that, to do responsibly and can be used.
Yeah.
You know, it can be misused.
So maybe at this point I should say, okay, so, you know, we've said, okay, we're not talking about everybody, and it's an admittedly, you know, not formally defined group of people that you're saying are in some sense part of a cult. So the question is then, what are the parts of this milieu that, leaving aside the question whether any one person in Anthropic, OpenAI, DeepMind is or was associated directly with what you're talking about, independent of that, what is the legacy of this like cluster of worldviews or whatever in Northern California that took shape? And of course, with any intellectual history, you run into the same problem. It's like, you know, oh, you mean this kind of Marxist or that kind of Marxist?
Yep.
And you mean, you know, which of the subgroupings of the subgrouping you're talking about, you know? So it's always vague, but you're saying there was something discernibly coherent in Northern California that is there still. And it has, you can see its legacy in these frontier AI labs, right? And,
yes.
And how would you, what is the most important part of that for our purposes?
Yeah, I agree exactly what you said. Like there's the saying, the only thing a leftist hates more than a right winger is another leftist.
Right.
And so this is definitely too, all these people hate each other, to be clear. Like, you know, all these people hate each other. Like, of course they do, right? So I'm being very broad and they're all going to hate my description of them. Of course, you know, everyone is going to hate my description. But I think what's the interesting legacy is kind of the things I was talking about earlier is that you have these, and basically what happened was, is that Leo Szilard in this world, you know, did not go to the government, did not go to the military, and instead decided to keep it secret and keep it private and start the race to create private companies. And here's where I think the core, there's a couple points here, but I think here's where the core problem is that this is a market failure. This is a classic market failure. There is a class of things which just we know markets don't solve. Markets are great. I love markets, where my food comes from. You know, they're very good to solve certain types of coordination problems. But we know there are other classes of coordination problems that markets just do not solve. This is well-known basic economic game theory.
Public goods versus private goods, positive and negative externalities. Yeah, it's like, this is not controversial in mainstream economics, what you just said.
Exactly. So very simple. And the problem of public security is not the kind of problem the markets solve well. And the problem of superintelligent risk is a public security problem. It's a public goods problem. It is not a private goods problem. So what the fundamental mistake that was made fundamentally, and the reason to a large degree while we're in this mess, where now we have, you know, a billion companies racing to build superintelligence that will kill everybody, is because they try to solve a public goods problem with private markets, which doesn't work. And it never has. Like, and it's predictably so. I'm not saying the government is awesome and like everything is great. It's just on pure, you know, standard game theory, we know how this is.
And let me get back. I mentioned negative externalities. This is, you know, a problem that is created by market dynamics that markets do not address. Classic example is like pollution. Car companies compete to get the best car out there. And since no one car buyer is absorbing, you know, the pollution, you know, the pollution is just expelled out there. Their car is not a particular problem for them. It's just that all cars collectively are a problem for people collectively in terms of the pollution they create. That's a negative externality. And I think you'd say, like an AI arms race, it leads to risky behaviors, among other things. You'd probably say a lot. But that's an example of a negative externality that is not going to be addressed by the market. Quite the contrary, the market seems determined to create as much AI risk as it can by itself. Although there are constraining factors, these companies want to be known as safety conscious, and that leads to a certain amount of behavior that is actually virtuous, and to some that is virtue signaling. We won't get into that yet, and maybe if you're up for it, this is going to eventually require a second conversation, kind of to explore all of this. But anyway, that's my little aside. That is an example of what you're talking about, right? Like, this is not a problem for the market alone to handle. What the problems AI creates for all of us.
Exactly. And this is like, I love complex, crazy stories that have a simple punchline, which is what I think this is. Like, I think fundamentally it all adds up to normality. It's just, this was never going to be a problem that can be solved by private markets. The fact that they believed that this could be solved with private markets was ideologically driven. It was not rationality driven. It was because they had this libertarian ideology, this idea that the government is a hindrance to geniuses like them. And only if we get out of the way, these problems would be solved. But no, in fact, it doesn't work for coordination problems. Like, you know, lone geniuses do not solve coordination problems. I'm sorry, it's just not how these things work. And there's this idea often that is still very, very common, especially in Silicon Valley, that markets are the solution to everything. And I'm not saying markets are bad. What I'm saying is they're one tool in our tool belt. And this is the wrong problem to be using them on. We have other tools. We should use them.
Okay. First of all, before we talk a little more, I know you have to go at some point. You'd be up for a second conversation.
Of course. Always fun.
Delve into all this because it really warrants it because in a way, we haven't gotten to what I suspect that you'll agree is something very important, which is a vision of this superintelligence thing and what it's going to be and what's going to be wonderful about it and how you could keep it under control and couldn't keep it under control. Because they're really important, like, you know, engineering questions raised by the worldview that, you know, well, why don't you say a little about this, like the plan? I mean, these people have a plan for it working out well in their own heads. They're not, you know, the people that you may think are proceeding recklessly are not sitting there thinking, I'm proceeding recklessly. This is going to be, you know, super intelligence is going to get out of control and either lead to some extremely dystopic sci-fi scenario or something somewhat worse, but not great. They're not thinking that that's going to happen. They think they're going to play a big role in it not happening. Right. And that has, and so I guess that has to do with the way the whole thing was conceived, like back in the day, right? I mean, like 15, 20 years ago, the way they were thinking about this thing, which for all I know is true, but the point is it took shape in this milieu, right? Is that right?
Yep.
And what would you say about that?
I think this is extremely right. I think that these ideas really formed in this, like, very self-flattering, very, you know, intelligence worshipping and like hero worshipping environment where like the hero CEO, you know, the Ayn Rand protagonist will be the one to solve it. But this is just not how the real world works. Like, this is not how the real world works. If you want to solve large-scale coordination problems at scale, you need foreign governments and diplomats and bureaucracies and stuff like this. And I'm not saying it's the best system, but it is the best one we have come up with so far. You know, democracy is the worst system except for all the other ones. You know, yeah. The idea that like individual heroic CEOs would somehow like be responsible for global, you know, security and international stability is crazy. Like, this is actually a crazy belief. And it's so normalized in these cultures. It's like fish and water. Like, people are just like, oh, if only Sam Altman did the right thing. And I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. You're begging the question. Why are we asking Sam Altman? Like, why is this hero CEO worship here going on? Sam Altman is not the general. He's not the president. He's not even part of this, you know, any of this. Like, I had a really funny conversation once where I met someone in Japan, who had grown up in Japan. And we were talking about AI safety and, you know, superintelligence and so on. And I was explaining, like, effective altruism and, like, you know, superintelligence risk and all this kind of stuff to him. And, you know, like, extinction risk, superintelligence, that all made sense to him. Yep, he was like, makes sense. There's one thing about EA he just couldn't understand. He was so confused by it. It's like, okay, makes sense. You know, there's all these, like, you know, AI poses a risk, you know, to humanity. Makes sense. But why are charities involved? This should be the military. Like, what is a charity doing here being funded by some billionaire? Like, this is crazy. And I think he's right. I think,
yeah, like, I mean, I will say, in theory, charities can address things markets don't address. And in fact, that's almost definitionally true. But what's odd about some of these charities is that they wound up giving money to the companies, right? Like open philanthropy. And I don't, look, I'm not passing any judgments. I don't know the landscape well enough, But it is an odd thing that a philanthropy was, and of course, people know that OpenAI has this odd history where it starts out as right-minded NGO and nonprofit and winds up, this capitalist machine. Somewhat, I guess you'd say the same as Anthropic. But anyway, that's like the corporate behemoths of previous technological revolutions don't start out as charities, right? Like, no, that's just weird. It shows in a way something, I guess, commendable, which is that they understood that they were dealing with something different that did pose distinctive problems. And I think they may have, I what do I know? Go ahead, take it away. Tell me what you're thinking.
I think people are complex. I think people are inconsistent. I think people change their minds. Yes, I do think a lot of people tried and failed in many ways. Like, charities can address many things that markets can address, yes, but they also can't address, say, military problems. That's not what they're for. You know, like, public security problems should not be solved by charities. There are reasons we don't do that. You know, we don't want charity police. You know, we want state police. Yeah. And so on. Like, there's just different categories. And so, but the thing with the charity is that, again, it's a private thing. It's a Randian thing. It's this idea that you have this private entity run by this genius CEO that will, like, solve the problem separate from the state. There's always this fascination with avoiding the state, circumventing the state in various ways. And now we could do a lot of psychoanalysis about why these people are, you know, don't want to engage with the state, you know, that they're so traumatized by interacting with the state. And I think there's many legitimate reasons to be traumatized from being interacting with the state, especially, you know, in certain countries. I understand. But fundamentally, this is basically a psychoanalytic reason that led to actual tactical, you know, mistakes by their stated reasons. And then comes back rearing its head is one of the roots of the ideology, transhumanism, is that I think there's a much simpler explanation for all of this. All of these strange things can be explained with one very simple observation. These people want to build superintelligence. That's the fundamental observation. They've always wanted to build. Dario wants to build superintelligence. If you just take this one sentence, Dario wants to build superintelligence, you can predict basically all of his actions. You know, whenever Anthropic suggests a new policy or supports something, ask yourself, does this stop Dario from creating superintelligence? And the answer will be 100% of the time, no. It might do other things. It might be good press. It might help chatbot security. I don't know. But it will never, ever get in the way of Dario creating superintelligence.
But sometimes it seems like you could have that effect. Like, they did this paper. Anthropic came out with this paper authored by, you know, Jack Clark, this guy at Anthropic, I think a former journalist who writes a lot. And it was about recursive self-improvement, which is, of course, as you alluded to it earlier, the idea that you get to a point where the AI is just, each generation of AI is just building the next generation with no human in the loop. Anyway, at the end of it, they say, look, you know, we may get to a point where it makes sense to slow down or even maybe they said even stop. I doubt it. But anyway, and that may require global coordination. And so we're going to establish some sort of process through which we study this. And well, I guess we'll get back to you. Maybe that's the key part is where they say we're going to start a committee. We'll let you know when you find something out. But in any event, ostensibly, at least, and you tell me, they seem to be focusing on a problem that you agree is a problem, and even saying, we may do this thing that keeps Dario from building superintelligence. That's what it seemed like.
So, I think this is a perfect example of what I'm talking about. Did publishing that paper stop Dario from building superintelligence? Yes or no?
I don't recall that exact phrase.
Of course not. It didn't slow him down or harm him or get in the way of Anthropic in any way. They are hiring for people on their website. They have, like, job postings for people to work on RSI. Like, they are do not listen to people when they speak. This is a very important skill to learn. When you're dealing with adversarial environments, such as politics or CEOs, you have to wash the hands, not the mouth. They will say whatever. It doesn't matter. Like, you want to hear X, they'll say X. Someone else wants to hear Y, they'll say Y. Like, they will just contradict themselves on everything. So the thing you have to watch is, what do they do? What are the what are the invariants that their actions uphold? And, you know, another great example is responsible scaling policies. This was the previous Anthropic thing.
Right. The dear departed responsible scaling policies. Yes. They formally abandoned the term, didn't they?
Yes. And so when it came out, I was like, this is obviously bullshit. They're not binding. There's nothing binding in here. There's
So these are things like, okay, these are things we won't do, like out of concern for safety. And I forget how they define them, but this is this will like keep us honest, so to speak. We'll pledge to you that our machines won't do this, we'll do this. And they just, I was surprised. Wouldn't it be smarter just redefine them than abandon?
So here's the thing. You think that's what they said. That's not what they said. I would recommend reading the paper. That's not what it said. That's what the headline said. But the actual paper was basically, we will evaluate what a future moment could look like in which we might have some restrictions of some form. We'll get back to you on that. Then, 2 years later, they came back and were like, actually, we're not going to do this. So here is a very important thing we haven't talked about so far, which is, I think, really a skeleton key to understand what's going on here. Fear, uncertainty, doubt, FUD. This is one of the most classic PSYOP strategies and marketing tactics. It goes all the way back to like Big Tobacco and so on. There's even a whole Wikipedia page of like the Big Tobacco playbook.
When they faced the cancer stats and wanted to evade the implications,
So here is how you should understand when you hear people like Dario or Demis or Sam or whatever, or any of these people talk about this. What you have to understand is their goal, they have one goal, which is to stall for time. Because they think they can get to superintelligence in a couple of years and then none of this matters. All they need to do is stall. They don't need to convince you. They just need to make you think, you know, that was interesting. They'll get back to us. Let's wait and see. They just need to make you confused. It's like ink cloud, you know, like an octopus shooting ink. It's just confusion. It's like all this stuff. And, oh, look, they put out this policy. And, wow, they did this thing. And, you know, this guy said this on Twitter. Wow, look at all the shiny jingling keys. But fundamentally, it's stalling.
It seems like if I were Anthropic, I had the motivations you suggest, I might be more inclined to say, you know, this thing is a long way off. Chill. We're not going to get to AGI tomorrow or superintelligence. But their estimates actually tend to be, same with OpenAI, on the near side.
Yes. And the reason for this is because you're not the audience. They want the AI engineers to come to them and pledge allegiance. They want the AI safety, super high IQ, less wrong people to work for them as engineers. So they have to signal to them. They have to be like, look, guys, you want to build super intelligence, right? So we can do it safe. Because there's a fundamental tension in the heads of basically all of these rationality, EA, et cetera, people, which includes many of the best engineers at these companies. And the tension is fundamentally, they want to build ASI. They want to build superintelligence. They've wanted to do it since they were like 12 years old. Like, they've always wanted to do this. They've read sci-fi stories. They've read Ian Banks or whatever. And like, they want to build superintelligence. And then the second thing is, they are unfortunately smart enough to understand that doing that wrong would be a bad idea. So what they need is they need someone, like a strong fatherly character, you know, in a psychoanalytic sense, to tell them, hush, hush, don't worry, we're going to do it well. If you're in the in-group, we're the good guys. So the messaging of Anthropic isn't for you. It's for future hires.
Wait, Anthropic does not want me to work for them? Is that what you're telling me, Connor?
I'm sorry to say.
I know a lot about AI. I could help.
You're not polyamorous enough. I'm sorry.
Oh, my God. I'm flexible. I'm flexible. Just tell me what lifestyle changes I need. Okay. Well, there's so many places this could go. And so I'm glad you're up for a second conversation because, I mean, one thing... ultimately, I mean, first of all, I think in the next conversation, I'm going to like review and recap and try to flesh out, get you say a little more about some of the connections between the emergence of this culture you've described and the cultures in the companies that are different from one another to some extent, but the legacy of the cultures in those companies and how that matters. But I also know that one thing that matters is this specific, like, superintelligence scenario where it gets back to what we said, alignment, right? It's like this idea that if we build the right kind of superintelligence, which means it's built by the right kind of person, which may mean me, we all think we're good. Like, right? I mean, honestly, I think I would like be responsible if you put me in charge of superintelligence. I'm not kidding. Like, we all think like that.
I don't.
But there is this assumption, first of all, there are all these assumptions about like, well, what can and can't alignment do? Will, in any event, will there be this kind of one machine that as long as you keep it in line, you're good? That'll get us back to, open weights / open source, which you have changed your views on since you were an important member of that community. So there's so much to discuss here. And I want to give you a chance to say any last thing you want to say. But first, I want to just say, I also want to get more into the cultural stuff because I so distinctly remember, as I said, when Wired magazine emerged. And there was the techno-futurism, transhumanism on the cover and stuff. But what's funny is there was also very much this granola vibe, like back to Earth, like, living off the land. And look, I know Kevin Kelly. I really like him. I think he's a good guy. He didn't go off to become part of what we're describing, but he was one of the important members of the community. Of course, Stewart Brand, Whole Earth Catalog. This is before your time. You don't remember Wired showing up, but it was, I imagined the Northern California hippie libertarian vibe that was clearly connected to the tech world, not winding up at with Palantir. Although actually now there's open war between Palantir and Anthropic. So never mind. Forget I said that because that Palantir is not really a direct offshoot. Let me just shut my mouth and give you a few minutes to say anything you want to say. And I hope that within a couple of weeks, we'll tape kind of a part two that reviews, fleshes out and, embraces and extends as Microsoft described its plan to kill Netscape, as I recall back in, which is also before your time. But anyway, go ahead.
I think the most important thing is, again, to understand is that fundamentally they're trying to stall. These people think that they are building a technology that will kill literally everyone on the planet. They will kill you. They will kill your children. They will kill your spouse. They will kill everybody. And they think it's worth it. They think they have the right to do this. What I think is that they don't. Previously, you said that everyone thinks that they would be responsible. I have thankfully grown out of this phase. I do not think that I should be in control of superintelligence, whatever that means. I don't think anyone should be. I don't think this is a decision that anyone gets to make unilaterally. I think, even if I built an aligned ASI, whatever the hell that means, I think that's a very bad thing because it means that I'm disempowering other people against their will. People have not consented to this. People have not. If I build a superintelligence, that means that I disempower literally everybody. I can disempower all the governments, all the private people and their private lives, everyone, families, etc. And I think power imbalances is very, very dangerous. Concentrations of power of any kind are very, very dangerous. And a superintelligence is
more dangerous than ever when this technology is around because...
Exactly. Yeah. AI is a massively power centralizing and concentrating power. And superintelligence is the most extreme form of that because you don't even need a human in charge anymore. You can just have the power run itself. Mm-hmm. So what I think is that this is why I stopped working on the technical problems because I realized even if I succeeded, I have not succeeded. In the sense I've made the problem worse. The actual problem we are facing is a political problem, not a technical problem. It is the question of how do we want to govern and how do we want to make choices like this as a society? How do we want to decide what experiments get run? What kind of technology is deployed or constructed in the first place? What kind of risk is the general public and our families exposed to? And these are choices that I think individual private people at companies should not be allowed to make. These should be decisions that are made democratically. These are choices that should be made by the people. And therefore, this is why I am part of Control AI, controlai.org, where we just really encourage people to reach out to their lawmakers, to reach out to make their voices heard that this is not acceptable and that this is not what people want. It is, in fact, not what people want. People don't want unelected billionaires in Silicon Valley gambling with the lives of them and their family. No one wants this. And we should demand that action. And we should not just demand, we should make sure that that action actually happens.
Okay. And one thing I would say in kind of wrapping up is, tell me if I'm wrong, but you're not just saying that it's your view that superintelligence is this super dangerous thing that no one, you know, that a handful of people with, in some cases, possibly eccentric worldviews, especially, should be in charge of. But you're also saying, and this is what I think connects it to the story, you're saying that these people themselves believe, at least according to their own past professions, superintelligence is this sci-fi level, incredibly dangerous thing. I mean, it would be one thing for Eliezer to be running up to somebody who runs IBM and saying, don't you understand, you know, these things are dangerous. And the guy's like, kid, I'm just focused on next quarter's profit. Shut the hell up. You're saying these people actually emerge from this culture where they believe this, at least in some cases, they believe it as strongly as anybody. And they're saying, but don't worry, I'm the guy who can make this work out well. Trust me. And again, I know that's not what they're explicitly saying. That's what I brought up. Like, well, they say this, they say that. And you're saying basically that's PR. But did I just accurately characterize an important part of the characterization between the situation we're in your view, and this culture in which a lot of important people in AI emerged?
Yes, I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, Dario has said before that he thinks it's like 20% up to 20% that AI could kill everybody. This is worse odds than Russian roulette.
By one chamber. Okay. Well, thanks so much. And again, it's Control AI. Also, do you spend much time on Twitter or anywhere where you want to advertise your own thing?
I am reluctantly on Twitter, at MP Collapse, or just my name, Connor Leahy. Than that, I also have a blog, which is linked from there, where I post very infrequently.
Yeah. Twitter, by the way, Elon has his own fascinating intersection with his technology. He didn't emerge in it, but...
Yeah, I didn't even touch on the whole Elon thing.
And I'm at Robert Reiter on Twitter, and I also have a book on AI called The God Test, which came out not long ago. And actually gets into a lot of this, a certain amount of this, like especially like the Bostrom book, Superintelligence, and Eliezer's worldview. And I contend that in some cases I've made Eliezer's arguments more persuasive than Eliezer. Judge for yourself. While being technically agnostic on whether he's right or wrong, but So thanks, and I'm glad we're going to see you again soon on this platform, Connor, because this is very important stuff.
Thanks so much for having me on.